Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Do you have a therapist? Have you ever considered visiting one? We're used to some famous film and TV therapists like Dr. Fraser Crane from Cheers or Dr. Jennifer Melfi from The Sopranos. But what is therapy like in real life? What does a therapist think when we reveal our innermost selves? What goes on in a therapist's mind? A new book called Maybe You Should Talk With Someone explores going to therapy for people with garden variety anxiety, depression, or relationship struggles. Written by Los Angeles psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb, the book is part self-help, part memoir as Gottlieb shares her own emotional struggles over the breakup of a serious relationship. She takes us behind the curtain of what therapy is really like and how she, as both a therapist and a patient, copes with the issues brought up by her patients and in her own life. Gottlieb is the author of the Dear Therapist column in The Atlantic and author of the previous book Stick Figure and Marry Him, The Case for Settling for Mr. Good Enough. Lori Gottlieb, author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Lori Gottlieb, welcome to Medical Monday. I want to start by asking you your inspiration for this book. You've written before, and as a psychotherapist, you have great insight and write very well, and also, I think, very humorously. But what led you to want to write in parallel about therapy, but also about your personal story?
I wanted to bring people into the therapy room. That was my original conception for the book, is I wanted people to see real people going through what I like to call the daily problems of living, some of which are very heartbreaking and some of which are more maybe relatable to day-to-day life. And I wanted people to see what the human condition is like in this culture of Facebook and Instagram and all of those other things. But I also felt like one of the main messages of the book is that we are more the same than we are different. And I didn't want to present myself as the expert up on high. I wanted to be just like everybody else because I am. And so I'm the fifth patient in the book. So you see my patients going through therapy, but you also see me landing in therapy after something a crisis happened in my life, and I end up working through that with my own therapist.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what really does make it special is that you present yourself as one of the patients in the story. And so I guess one thing that surprised me was that when you went, and your therapist in the book is named Wendell, and that's what you call him. And the calculus for how you found him was fairly elaborate, because as a therapist, you had to be cautious about your privacy and also about who you were going to see. So I guess take us through a little bit of that thinking about how you found him.
It's such an interesting question, because even though I, as a therapist, don't feel that there's any stigma around coming to therapy, I did feel that there was some maybe shame around needing to go to therapy for something myself. And I also had trouble finding a therapist because I can't see anybody that I know. Your therapy relationship has to be its own distinct relationship. So I'm in a suite of other therapists at the office. I go to a weekly consultation group where we discuss our cases with other therapists. A lot of my friends are therapists, and some of the best therapists I knew were not people that I could see. So I had to find somebody outside of my world, and I called a colleague whom I trust. And I was sort of, quote unquote, asking for a friend because I knew that her referrals would always be good ones. And later, of course, I told her that the referral had been for me. But it's interesting that even I, as a therapist, had some trepidation around being open about the fact that I needed to go see a therapist.
You know, one of the things that I also found incredibly interesting was, in spite of the fact that you do, in some ways, right as an all-knowing narrator about your own patients, it's that when we get into our own personal emotional turmoil, you know, we can kind of go back to square one. And so your initial sessions with Wendell, it seems like you were almost stuck in a little bit of a repetitive pattern. And I don't think it spoils anything to say that the reason you sought some psychotherapy was for a difficult breakup of a relationship. And, you spent a lot of time early on, I think, definitely looking for sympathy and looking for validation, but it took Wendell maybe some great insight and some sort of not strange, but, you know, different tactics to get to break through to you to kind of break you out of that pattern. Is that, I guess, what would you say now that you can reflect on it about those early therapy sessions for you?
I think that when I went to therapy, I was very much like my patients are with me, which is that the presenting problem, the thing that people come in with, is often indicative of a larger struggle or pattern that got them into that situation in the first place. And so a lot of people come to therapy, as did I, because they want validation. You know, didn't I dodge a bullet with that boyfriend? Or can you believe my partner? Or can you believe my boss? And we're not there to give validation. We're there to help you understand something about yourself that you might not have seen before. We all have blind spots. And a therapist is there to hold up a mirror to you and help you see your reflection in a more clear way so that you don't keep falling into the same trap over and over.
What was it that Wendell did, I guess, that got you out of the trap of sticking into the same rut?
Right. Well, I think that he did something different than my friends did. So I talk in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And idiot compassion is what we do with our friends because we want to support them and make them feel better. So we agree with their assessment. We agree with what they're saying. Yeah, you're right. That person was, you know, mistreated you. But what the therapist will do and what Wendell did was he didn't take that tack. He very much wanted me to see that even though I thought I was blindsided by this revelation, and the revelation was that my boyfriend and I were planning to get married, and he suddenly told me that he had decided that he couldn't live with a kid under his roof for the next 10 years, that kid being my 8-year-old, and his kids were about to leave for college, and he was about to taste the empty nest, and he had been grappling with this for quite a while but hadn't told me about it. So my position was that I was very blindsided by this. But Wendell pointed out that there were ways that I was avoiding some of these issues with him, too. And I think that even though it's hard to look at ourselves that way, it's so beneficial in the long run to see what was I doing so that it doesn't happen again.
Yes, that's an excellent way to frame it or contextualize it. Another thing that I think the book does a great job at, and I think your writing really reveals, is it takes the reader behind the curtain, so to speak, of what it's like for a therapist. And I think any of us that have been to therapy have a certain expectation of the therapist's office or the chair or the couch we sit on and kind of what that appointment will be like. But you share with us what, you know, how you contextualize multiple patient visits in a day or the patients that might exhaust you or how you perhaps share some of the insights or some of the characteristic patterns from patients that you see. And that was such a joy. I think readers will definitely enjoy this. Can you share with us some of the different scenes that you provide, you know, where it's maybe not what the typical patient might think? That is where you share stories with other therapists, for example, or friends?
Yeah. So I really wanted to demystify what therapy is. I think a lot of people are reluctant to go seek help because they imagine that you're going to go to a therapist's office and then you're going to be stuck there for years and you're going to talk about your childhood the whole time. And it's really not like that. It's very much about this very rich human connection where you can talk through something and see it from a perspective that might be more helpful. So I think that in the book you see, I think people, you know, I worried about the same things with my therapist that I think people worry about with me, which is, does the person like me or am I boring them? And why is he saying this at this moment or why is she saying this at this moment? And I think that, you know, I talk about how I'm not bored by my patients. They're not there to entertain me. Therapy isn't a cocktail party. You know, the patients who bore me are the ones who keep me at bay, who won't let me in, who won't share their lives with me. And I think that people are worried that their lives aren't interesting enough. But I think people don't bore you with their day-to-day lives. I find the truth of who they are to be incredibly interesting. And I think the things that people hide because of shame or, you know, embarrassment are the things that draw me to them. And I think that would draw other people to them also. so many times people come to therapy and they're holding so many secrets from the world, from people close to them, from their therapist, and even from themselves. And in therapy, we really look at what are they hiding from me and what are they hiding from themselves? Because once they share the truth of who they are, they become much more interesting. And it's ironic because people hide the truth of who they are because they think that it's going to push people away. But the opposite actually happens. And I think that's important for people to know about therapy.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Lori Gottlieb, who is a psychotherapist in Los Angeles and author of the new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And Lori Gottlieb is also the weekly therapy columnist in The Atlantic, Dear Therapist. And Lori, you were alluding to the fact that sometimes you have patients who are unrevealing or who are emotionally hiding out. And I can think of no better example of that than the first patient you introduce us to, who goes by the name of John in the book. And he starts out essentially his first several visits on a rant, just that everybody else is an idiot and nobody understands him. And share with us what he was hiding, or at least how you were able to kind of pierce his veil, his sort of self-protective shell.
Yeah, so when I first meet John, he is a very successful Hollywood producer, which is not indicative of my usual clients. And he is very much, he's very abrasive, he's very insulting to me. He tells me that he came to me because I was a nobody, because he didn't want to run into any of his colleagues in the waiting room, so he didn't have to worry about that with me because I was a nobody. He said that he didn't want his wife to know that he was in therapy, so he would just hand me a wad of cash at the end of the session, and he said, "You'll be just like my mistress." And he was very...
charming.
charming, right. But the thing about that is I think that a lot of people, we personalize their behavior, but their behavior is about them some of the time, and it's a way to protect themselves from the unspeakable or the incredibly painful things in their lives. And once I come to know him, which comes out later on through this process of really kind of getting in there with him, you know, you see the trauma and the tragedy, and I don't want to spoil what it is, but you see it underneath, and I think he becomes so lovable. And people who have read the book so far say that they really hated him at the beginning, and they really, you know, came to develop this incredible affection for him by the end. And that's what happens with the therapist, too, is that you don't really know someone when they first come in. They're protecting themselves in all the ways that is normal, you know, that people are human, and when they can't face something, they find a way to cope with it. Maybe that coping strategy isn't serving them anymore, and that's part of what they're in therapy to learn about.
Well, that's well said, and you also do such a fine job, and I think of selecting the patients that you've written about and whether they're emblematic of the gamut of life. For example, you have a patient who you care for who goes by the name of Julie, who is a young woman in her 30s but has breast cancer. So very unfortunate in terms of advanced illness at a young age. And contrast that with Rita, who's in her almost 70 when you meet her, who meets you and presents herself as if her life is over. And so you have people with different stages of life who are going through both some similar thematic emotional elements, but are also, you know, obviously have very different concerns. But in picking these patients as touch points for your writing, it seems like you do a good job of creating a mosaic of sort of the interesting nature of what you do, but also how complicated it can be.
Right. I wanted to pick patients who, first of all, I picked patients whom I'm no longer seeing because I didn't think that I could do the therapy work with them and also be writing about them. It would interfere with the work. So, and the patients that I picked were very different in terms of, you know, life stage and gender and family history and personality and the issues and struggles that they're dealing with. And so you have everything from John, who we just spoke about, to Julie, who is newly married and discovers right when she gets back from her honeymoon that she has breast cancer, which later becomes terminal cancer, and she asked me to go through to stay with her until she dies. And it was a really profound experience to really, because of Julie, look death in the eye that way and not do all the things that we do as people to try to comfort the person or make them feel better, but to really meet them where they are in that process. And it makes us think about our own mortality, and we don't need a terminal diagnosis to start to be more intentional in our days and about how we're spending our time. You know, what are we waiting for certain things? And I think there's another woman in the book that I write about, Charlotte, who's in her 20s, and she keeps hooking up with the wrong guys, and she really wants a relationship, but she keeps picking guys that will never give her that, and including one from the waiting room eventually. And so really kind of unraveling those patterns from childhood. And then we have, the woman you spoke about, Rita, who is about to turn 70, and she's kind of made a mess of her life by her account, and her adult children are estranged from her, and she's had some marriages, and she's the most isolated person I had ever met. And she says, I'm giving myself a year, and if my life doesn't get better, I'm going to end it. And it's really astonishing that when people come to therapy, you think, oh, well, what could really change in a year? So much changes for her. But I think that when people come to therapy, it's because they're ready on some level to make change, even if they're not fully conscious of it. So when people come in, not only do I ask why are you here, but why now? Why this week, this month, this year did you call me, even though these issues might have been going on for longer? What made you call now? What made you ready? Because I'm scanning for strengths as much as I'm trying to understand what's not working.
I'm curious, because you write with such a fresh ear and fresh eye, you did not start your career as a psychotherapist. You started your career very differently. And I guess I was wondering if you would recount for our listeners sort of your career journey and how you wound up becoming a psychotherapist when you didn't start out that way.
Yeah. So the book is also part memoir, and I write about my circuitous route to becoming a therapist. I started off working as first a film development executive in Los Angeles, and then I moved over to network TV. And when I was working at NBC, this show called ER, which later became very popular, was on the air. It had just started that year, and we had a consultant in the emergency room who was a physician, and I would love hanging out with him. I loved the stories that we were telling in the shows. I felt like they were really important stories about the human condition, but I also felt that in the real ER, you saw real life in a way that was different from fiction. And I ended up going to medical school. And when I was in medical school, it was right at the time when managed care was just coming into play. And I realized that I wasn't going to be able to do what I wanted to do, which was to really guide people through their lives as their physician. It was going to be much more about I think seeing a lot of people in the course of a day in 15-minute increments. And I ended up publishing a book when I was there, and I started writing for newspapers and magazines, and I became a journalist, which I was really happy to do because now I got to tell people stories and really engage with people on that deeper level. And it wasn't until I had a baby about 10 years later that I realized I really wanted colleagues and sort of adult people to talk to during the day. When the UPS guy would come with deliveries, I would sort of say, you know, how's the weather and how about these diapers? And he'd sort of back away to his big brown truck, and I knew that I needed to expand my professional world. And so I called up the dean at the medical school I'd been at, and she, and I said, maybe I should come back and do psychiatry. And she said, I don't think that's what you want to do, because you're going to probably end up doing mostly medication management, and I think you want to do something where you have these longer-term, deeper relationships with the people that you see. And she was right, and so I got a graduate degree in clinical psychology, and I went that route, and that was how I became a therapist. So I went from telling people stories as a journalist to helping in some small way to change their stories as a therapist.
I just love the sort of, to borrow the television script room, that's a writer's room, the narrative arc of that journey because it's, I mean, you at every point were open to new learning and to kind of making a difference and then to sort of following advice, but then forging your own path. I mean, it's kind of an interesting trajectory. It really is. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Lori Gottlieb, a psychotherapist in Los Angeles, who is the Dear Therapist weekly columnist in The Atlantic, but also just has the brand new book, and I should say best-selling book out, called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. And Lori, I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about your writing in The Atlantic. So you do a weekly column. I know you're on leave temporarily because of your book tour, but what kinds of questions do you get asked, or what kinds of things do you address in your column there?
I address everything. I think it's really interesting to see the letters that come in because I think they really speak to what people's concerns are and what they're struggling with and what they're wanting guidance on. So it's very similar to the kinds of things that people bring into the therapy room, but the difference is that in the therapy room I can ask follow-up questions and I have a relationship with that person, and there's another week if I miss something that I can go back to, or if we didn't get to it or I think of it later. In in the letter, you just have this one perspective. It's this one person's perspective. I don't know how the other characters in the story that this person's writing in about would tell the story if they were writing a letter to me. So what I'm helping people to do is I'm not just giving advice like, here's what you should say to your mother-in-law, but I'm helping them to see how a therapist might think about their situation and the kinds of questions that a therapist might be asking of them so that they can make a better choice about what they want to do. So I give them probably more guidance than I give in the therapy room, but I also help them to think about it from a broader perspective, the way I would with any therapy patient.
I'm curious, as someone who answers reader mail, how much of a say do you have in the selection, or did the editors help you select what you'll write about? I mean, ultimately, you're writing the response, so I guess you have to select. But do you ever get follow-up when you've written a response to someone that sort of goes public like that? Obviously, the person isn't identified, but do you ever get to close that loop, so to speak, or even years later, have someone say, oh, hey, thank you so much for your advice, or, I tried that and it didn't work?
I do. It's really gratifying when people write in after, they know that the column is running. I always tell them the week before that I'll be answering their letter, so they know to look for it. And it's really gratifying when people write in and say, hey, I hadn't thought about it that way, or I tried this thing that you suggested, and here's how it went. It's always nice to hear that the advice, helped in whatever way that it did. Or it made them think about something in a different way. Or, like recently there was a column about something that was going on in someone's marriage, and the husband had written in, and he came off as sort of unlikable in the letter, but I knew that there was more to this story. And I wrote back, and I hope a way that helped him to see something about his wife's experience that he wasn't seeing. And he wrote back, and he said, that was so helpful. And I, even though I still feel this way about it, that helped me to see how she feels about it now. And that's helping us to talk about it in a better way. So yeah, I really like getting that feedback. And in terms of letter selection, I choose the letters, and then my editor, I make sure that my editor is okay with the letter that I chose, and that's how the selection happens. I always feel bad when I choose a letter because there are so many that I want to answer, and it's a once-a-week column, and so I don't get to answer them all. And sometimes I'll answer them later. I might save some of them for a later date. And, I always feel bad because I want people to know that even if it didn't run the week that you wrote it in, I might answer it later. So don't lose hope.
I have another question related to that, but also around your career trajectory, which is that you were kind of given advice about not going into psychiatry because it would be a lot of 15-minute appointments and the advent of managed care, et cetera, and how you went into psychotherapy because you wanted to practice the way you want. And similarly, because you maybe got a slightly later start in terms of being a psychotherapist, And that is about burnout. And you definitely are in a community of therapists and share stories with them. And I wonder, this is something going on in the medical profession a great deal. And I'm an internist, and I read constantly on blogs and articles and various journals and news magazines and among medical students. There's a great deal of depression, anxiety, and certainly a high suicide rate. So I'm wondering if, you having, in a sense, so much control and so much creative output in terms of your writing, if that is how you manage to keep things balanced, or what advice you might have for other professionals who might be experiencing a little bit of burnout, seeing multiple patients in 15-minute visits.
Right. Well, I specifically don't do that, but I do see people who do. And I think that the people who do that, they really, underneath it all, there's sort of the logistical stress of their jobs, but they're very passionate about what they do. And I think it's important for those people to hold on to that passion and not lose it. And I think self-care is really important, especially for people in the medical profession. Making sure that as much as they can, that they aren't neglecting their personal lives, their families, even just getting outside and taking a break in the day, walk around the block, make sure you're eating, make sure you're sleeping. If you are struggling with something, make sure that you get help so that you don't wait. It's funny, people in the medical profession, I think if something were wrong with their bodies, right, like they were experiencing chest pain, they would go to a cardiologist and get that checked out before they had a heart attack. But I think that especially for people in the medical profession, if something's going on emotionally, they will minimize it or kind of ignore it and try to tamp it down. But it just gets bigger. If you try to tamp down these feelings, they search for air, and eventually they'll find it. And so, or it comes out in behaviors, like a colleague of mine calls the internet the most effective short-term non-prescription painkiller out there. So they spend a lot of time on the internet or drinking or drugs or, whatever they're doing, or drama in relationships, or, come out in behaviors. And then they end up, eventually maybe, they come to therapy, but at the time when they're having the equivalent of an emotional heart attack. And at that point, it's harder to treat than it would have been if you had come earlier. And also, you struggled unnecessarily for a long time. So I really encourage people who are in these high-stress jobs that they're also very passionate about to make sure that they don't neglect self-care.
I have just one last question for you, and it may be the full circle question, which I think I read somewhere that this book, your new bestseller, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, has been optioned and is possibly in the works as a TV series?
Yeah, so Eva Longoria is developing the book into a television series.
That is so exciting. Well, congratulations on that. And so I assume you'll produce or be some kind of technical advisor on some of the material they're in, or script writer?
I'll be a producer on the project, yes.
That's so exciting. When can we look for that to come out?
I don't know. There are a lot of steps that have to happen between writing the script and getting it on the air. But I really hope that if it does get on the air, that the show portrays a person who happens to be a therapist, and not just, I think the ways that we think about therapists in film and TV maybe haven't been the most realistic. And I hope that this is a show that's about a person who has a full life and happens to be a therapist, and you can see both sides of that, much like I try to do in the book.
The name of the book is Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed, and it is by my guest today, Lori Gottlieb, who is also a psychotherapist in Los Angeles and writes the Dear Therapist column weekly for The Atlantic. Lori Gottlieb, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.